FCO, entity 0212, complex.
DPS, go. Inco, go. PUS, go. Surgeon, go. Booster, go. Copy that, we have a go from you guys.
This is Talking Sound.
Well, hello everybody, and welcome to the Talking Sound Podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host, live in the studio in Austin, Texas today. My guest is actually an old friend that I used to run sound for in Maine, of all places, who is relocated to Austin, Eric Betancourt, multi-instrumentalist actually, mainly guitarist and singer, songwriter. Very folksy rock sound to what he does, and one of the best damn jam guitarists that you'll ever hear. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
How have you been doing, man?
Good. Probably the outward it looks like I've been dormant, but I've been really laying quite a bit of groundwork for my future.
Yeah.
Whatever it's going to be with this, as music changes or what it means and how to make money at it and how to make a so-called living at it.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to cope with it and evolve with it as best I can and lay the groundwork for basically any type of changes that might come. I know it sounds weird. It sounds like a big thing, but I'm really, that's kind of what I've been doing for like 2 years.
Well, that's the thing though, is that you really do. And that's one reason why I wanted to have you on the show is, you really do have to have a long play concept. Whenever you come into any facet of this industry, whether it be from the technician side where I've lived and we know each other from, to the musician side where you are, it's one of those you have to have an idea of longevity with it when you start out. If I think you can burn out really quick if it's all go rock and roll all the time.
Yeah, well, it's insanely different from when I started out. Like, I had a clear idea of what I wanted to do. Because back then, you could kind of, like, make a record, have it matter, and kind of get some footing and have it, if it had some teeth, you could kind of get there with it. Or somewhere, you could kind of get up to the next notch. But it's basically an audio, it's a business card you can listen to.
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't matter. Everything's so impermanent. So that's been part of my philosophy, is realizing, like, kind of taking the weight off. Like, it doesn't, if I don't put a record out,
that's like, okay.
Well, like, and I don't know, it's hard to explain, but I feel like nobody really cares anymore. Everyone is so, I mean, people care, don't get me wrong. I'm overgeneralizing for sure.
Sure.
But nobody, what am I trying to say here?
I think the point of expectation on an artist to, like, a prime example would be like Rush, where for 30-something years, dependably every other year, they put out an album.
Well, I would like to be doing that, and I'm trying to gear myself up to do that. And I guess what was holding me back for so long is, like, when you put a record out, it had to count. You know, it's like,
yeah.
I was really, you know, I'm very proud of everything I've put out. I listen, if I hear it, I want to redo it again, of course. But I'm still, for where I was at then and what I did and what I put into it, I'm proud of everything I've done. So, but I'm realizing, like, this moving forward is like, you just got to get shit out there.
Yeah.
Because it's like, there's so much to listen to. Before there wasn't. Like, everyone has their own private favorite bands that nobody else has ever freaking heard of.
Yeah.
You know? And it's just like, I just don't even think, there's a collective conscious anymore of, like, kind of what everyone's listening to. Like, everyone's listening to so much stuff. So to me, I feel like I'm putting it out there and I can just start putting stuff out and the weight is off as far as worrying. Like I've been holding up because I got these songs, and when the bands and I recorded them live, like, we practice all summer or for a year or two with these songs and then go in the studio and just do them. And then I'd work on my parts later and I would just kind of get bummed about it. Cause I'm like, well, this song, this isn't the face I want to present. It works live, but I really had this whole other idea. And I kind of, I've just been over that. I realized, like, well, I'm going to put out what we worked on.
Yeah.
And I can immediately put those same songs out again in a different incarnation. It doesn't matter. Yeah,
exactly.
At all.
Like, and it's really wild. I tell people this all the time on this show, with the digital world the way it is, you could release 8 different remixes of your song.
Yeah.
You know, and if you remember, like, back in the day, bands like Sugar Ray, like, good God, how many versions of All Around the World were there? Like, 6 different ones that you can hear on the radio that are just remixes and, like, featuring this DJ or featuring that person. Like,
yeah.
And at that point, you had to be willing to put out singles. You had to be willing to put out CDs.
Right.
You had to be willing to, like, tag it on to somebody else's CD who was the featured artist.
Right.
Whereas now, like you were saying, you can...
I don't think you can oversaturate.
No, I really don't think you can.
Because it's people... The attention span and the oversaturation is so heavy that it's like... I don't even have delusions about, like, my best friends ever hearing my full next record. I just feel like everyone is so spread out and into their own little worlds.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't think anybody cares. So for me to put it out there is just like it's just more hooks.
Yeah.
And I'm fine with that. If it goes unnoticed, oh well, I'm still going to do my best.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's what I've been doing kind of the lead up to the next one, which is really coming along. I've been doing it.
Yeah,
because doing a lot on it lately.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've been working on Bric-a-Brac for a little while now. The name of the upcoming album out there, folks, is Bric-a-Brac.
It was originally supposed to be done in a weekend. It was the summer of 2016, I guess, and it was at the very end of the summer. I was in Maine, spent 4 months up there, and we just jammed these songs out 2 or 3 times a week, pretty much doing all my music out, and just really got it fine-tuned and... They're feeling good, so we went to this camp. We brought basic gear and set up, and in a few hours, tracked all the drums and bass. And so I stayed at the camp for another week and kept working. But for some reason, I got shingles, and that was like hell. So that just stopped everything.
Yeah.
I had too much to do. I was trying to get back to Maine. It was just the most hellish experience I've ever been through. So basically, when I got past that and finally get back down to Texas. And I kind of listened to him, and it was just going back to that thing I was saying. It's like, I think these songs are good, but it's good live. It was a good live way of playing, good grooves in that way, but there's so many other ideas I had. And so then I started to redo them over the last few years. And now I'm just getting back into realizing, like, shit, those other ones are pretty tight.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to finish them up and be okay with that coming out as a collection of songs that was mostly done in a day.
Yep.
In a live spot with real people, you know. And then I've got some other ones that won't be on there that are almost done. So I have 2 albums that are kind of in the can in a sense.
Yeah.
3 albums actually.
That's always nice to know that artists like yourself, number one, are still out there making music. Because I've known you got to be close to a decade now at least.
Oh, more than that. Sure.
Yeah. And worked with you many, many years ago. I think I've seen you one time since you moved here to Austin. I think I randomly purchased a pedal board from you on Craigslist.
Was that it?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was going to say,
Random meeting where it was like, no way. You have a main phone number. And then we started chatting. And it was like, holy shit, Betancourt. and I had seen that you'd recently moved down here. That was years ago. But one of the things that I always said when I lived in Maine was that it was very much like Austin with an ocean view. The scenes, I think, are somewhat similar in the way that people ingest their music and the way that people take in their music. I think the audiences are somewhat similar in the way that they're segregated. Very much so. Like this side of town, these bands normally play on. That kind of stuff. People tend to float to certain sides of town to play.
Yeah.
But as an outsider coming into the Austin music scene, let's start off with some of the things that you have enjoyed about the Austin music scene coming down here. Because it's a long jaunt. I mean, you could not get... The only way you could really get further away into another music scene would be to go to L.A., there's really not a huge music scene between here and LA, between Central and West Coast. So, What was it like for you to uproot yourself from the base that you knew, the dedicated fans of Eric Bettencourt's solo music, and come down here to kind of strike your own?
Oh, I was ready to. I was just ready to. I mean, I just, you know, it's like it was. I hesitate to say like you could hit a ceiling, because I didn't. I wasn't like the best, most well known artist in Maine, but I knew for what I wanted to do, I kind of got bored with it. And I think I just needed more stimulation, a little bit. You know, sure, there was always great music, but like in Maine, it felt like I'd find like maybe one show a week that would really like kill me. But like when I moved here, there's like three a night anywhere all the time.
Yeah.
Insane musicians. And yes, you know, that's the thing I always try to stress is like Maine has just the highest caliber musicians any place in the world. You know, we know the scene. It's great. But there's so few that there's not that much choice. Like here, there's so many.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we have one sick keyboard player. Wow, he's amazing up there. But down here, there's like 700 of the sickest keyboard players. So you can, there's just something for every taste in a lot of it.
Yeah.
And I just get bored with things quick. I need to be learning like from something. So like it's just good that there's like 3,000 sick guitar players I can go watch at any one time. And always never get tired.
Well, and I really think, especially stylistically, the way that you play, you are a meld of a lot of different styles. So I think for a musician like you to be able to go out and take in the folk scene that's here, take in the eclectic jam scene that's here, the roots rock scene, that kind of stuff, I think it really does kind of expand your base. And expectation on yourself as far as, you know, where to stretch your legs. It's not that, like you were saying, that there aren't good musicians in Maine. It's that there are good musicians in Maine. They're just so cloistered together.
Yeah.
And it's a very incestuous scene because of the size of the music community, like where the music revolves, that people ping from band to band and... it's very often that, you know, you're going to be in a band with Orion Sear or, you know, Kevin Roper.
I think it's like that here too, as far as the incestuousness of it goes.
It's just that you have far more number of bands in which the incestuousness is happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be, 90% more. I mean, even per capita, you know, if you took Maine and made it 10 million people, it still wouldn't have the same, there's so much good music here. It's just crazy. I mean, it's impossible to get bored or ever see everything. It's just impossible. I feel like I'm almost every week if I go out, you haven't heard so-and-so, and you find out, like, it's some staple of Austin that everybody knows, and I've been here for almost 6 years, I never heard of him, and then you're just, like, kind of like...
Yeah.
Out of nowhere. Again, every other day, there's a new, like, you've never heard of blah, blah, so-and-so, blah, blah, Dylan or something? It's like...
Yeah, I've been here going on 8 years now, and... I'm constantly finding new stuff.
Always.
There are all kinds of hidden gems, all kinds of tucked away places.
Yeah.
What are a couple of your favorite rooms in town to play?
Well, I've been fortunate to have got into Seaboys.
Oh, nice.
With this group I started called The Thursdays, which is this strange little trio of... Andrea McGee she plays the barong, which is a Irish drum. She's from Ireland. They're over here on work visa. She's constantly on tour with Brian Wilson though.
Nice.
She's in a band called B Revival. So we're supposed to play this Thursday, but she has to ship out earlier. We're going to be playing anyway. And this other cat, David Jimenez, is just one of the most soulful singers. And just, I heard him play guitar in this band called Baby Atlas a few years ago, and it was just floored me. I mean, I'm pretty much over wanking guitars at this point. You know what I mean? Like, he could totally do that, but it's just tasteful. I mean, you feel it when he plays, and that's what I'm interested in. Somehow, I'm lucky enough to be in a band with these guys. So anyway, to answer your question, Sea Boys is a favorite one, and I really like Staygold as well, though I've never played there, and I haven't haven't tried, but I always like the vibe, and it seems like bands are happier, and people take care of you over there.
Yeah.
They don't dick you around. So those are two of my favorites. I play the Townsend a couple times a year. It's to sell tickets, and I usually play with some other musician. This year I'm playing with David Hamburger, who I don't know if you know him. He's
I do know of him, yes.
Amazing. I'm playing with him and David Jimenez. We're all kind of mutual admirers of each other, so that's going to be on the 21st of December. Yeah, ticketed kind of deal, yeah.
Okay, and that's at which location?
The Townsend, right across from the Paramount Theater on Congress Street. Yeah, it's just directly across. There's a whole venue in the back. It's
great.
Beautiful sound, run by one of the same guys, at this guy Carlos, who used to do the sound over at Strange Brew.
Okay.
Which used to be the hub, the place.
Yeah. I was going to say, I know you played there frequently. You were at Hills for a while as well, weren't you?
Well, Hills closed, unfortunately. Yeah, that's where I started my Thursday thing. We were doing a Thursdays with the Thursdays every Thursday. And then it closed down. I didn't know where. The place had been there for 70 years.
Yeah.
So
it's been a wild jaunt here in Austin over the last year or so, with places closing, places moving. Like even Antone's moved from their historic location for a while.
I'm glad at least they're open again.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and then Threadgills was, what a sad thing that is. It's tough. It's such a tenuous relationship to working here. You know, you just never know. Like you could just have a few good gigs, and it's a hard place to. You just can't count on anything. I mean, I was playing Strange Brew, had been for 3 months every week.
Yeah.
Like, that was rated the best singer-songwriter venue in this, maybe in this state.
And hands down, some of the best sound in Austin.
Oh, yeah.
The room was great.
Yeah, well, that was Brian Cates, who's over at Sea Boys now a lot. Sure else he's doing. Carlos, who I just mentioned. And actually, I was doing Sunday nights there, too, kind of for a while, giving them a break. But it's just like, even like you take places like that, like Hills, which has been there 70 years, and then Strange Brew, which was just like the best venue, and now they're gone just like that. I mean, you just can't count. That's what made me realize you can't count on anything.
Yeah.
You got to keep stretching your workout ahead of you and not ever just, you cannot... I could become complacent in Maine. Kind of once I got in places, I didn't have to do any booking anymore.
Well, yeah, yeah.
I had no problems. Every year, just they'd call back, and I'd get a bunch of gigs, and I'd be there constantly. And,
you know what's interesting? Because of course I was there right after the as the real crest of the Ale House was going on, and just as it was starting to leave, and it had become kind of this little legendary spot in Portland.
Yeah.
And I really think that when that closed down, it was one of those, like, it really started hitting people like, wow, whoa, wait a minute. This could happen to any of our favorite
And then
places.
Big Easy.
Big Easy was right after that.
I mean, it's kind of technically reopened again, but...
Yeah, it's been through a few incarnations.
It's pretty solid now as Portland House of Music.
Yeah. Yeah, I see those guys online all the time, and they've done a really great job with the venue and with the space and with keeping it up and alive.
I think Ken does great.
But
it's, a few times.
But, you know, it is strange that these places that are staple venues, like whenever, my God, the name of the place just left my head, the one with the night outside. It had been here for years as well. It was over by the Highball Bowling.
Not Geno's.
No, not Geno's. I'm thinking here in Austin.
Oh.
It's strange to see the places that we know and love going away. And yet still at the same time, the scene kind of keeps rolling, but in a different right. You know, what are you as a singer-songwriter seeing in venues with musicians? How do you see them reacting to this kind of stuff?
I don't know. I think, like you said, everyone's just kind of going with it. I have a little more of a pessimistic view that I've kind of... Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with pessimism. It helps you to plan for the future, you
sure.
know? But I think that music, in the sense of like where we're used to it, where you get these crowds that will come to your shows, I think it's going to get harder and harder and harder here. Because mm-hmm. It's just being infiltrated by the young crowds who music is not part of their culture and they don't give a shit. You can tell.
True.
You know, I've played these young bars. They don't care. They have, I feel like YouTube in a way has like killed the live star. In a sense, because it's you can see anything amazing all the time.
Video killed the radio star again.
Pretty much, man.
Who knew that the Buggles were such prophets? Yeah. You know.
Yeah, I guess that's a sense of like you. There's a futility, I suppose, to it, and
yeah,
and I mean the crowds, at least the ones that come to mind, they're an older batch of people.
Yeah.
They're like, you know, little baby boomers, a little older and retired. Man, it's a morbid thought, but 10, 15 years from now when they're gone, like, I can't even picture who's going to populate these shows.
Yeah.
I really can't. I mean, go to the Saxon, go to
Saxon
tons
Pub,
of these clubs.
That's the one. That's
even
the one.
El Mercado, who we were talking about earlier. And
yeah.
It's an older crowd, and I just don't see the gap being filled in too much. You know, you can go to one-to-one, and there's these younger bands. And I'm of the opinion it's a lot like the Big Easy was, where it's mostly like your friends and other yeah. bands that come to see you.
Yeah.
That's not really the culture
yeah.
of it. That's just like a place where musicians go to see musicians.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, even whenever I help book bands, stuff like that, that was always, and like I was saying before the show, talking about Shakuhachi Jones, my old band with my buddy Wes Goins. Our question to bars that were like, how many people do you bring to the show was, you know, I don't know, on a Tuesday night without music on the stage, how many people do you have here drinking? You know, we normally just turned it right around. Like, I'll ask you the same thing. How many people do you have drinking liquor? Even if I tell people it's free during my show.
Yeah.
Like, it's free to come in. I don't want you to charge a cover at my show. I'd prefer to get a 10% cut of the bar during my performance because most of my people are 30 plus. They have kids. They're happy to be out until 9 or 10 p.m. on a Wednesday or Thursday night. They've got a babysitter, so they're going to be drinking hard, and they're going to be drinking hard from 7 to 10 while we're playing a set, while we're doing stuff, you know? So yeah, I could easily bring 10 or 15 people that would run up $100 bar tab in 3 hours, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was my concept. It was, I'd much rather have people there drinking and spending money at the bar and make money off the bar than to make money off a cover. Because, yeah, if it's a cover, typically you're dealing with the fact of you're playing to the band's friends. And it's with the baby boomers, with 40-plus crowds, stuff like that, you tend to have people with disposable incomes. You tend to have people who are more into buying merch.
And they were also
CDs.
Around, too, when this place became
yeah.
what it became in the
yeah.
60s and 70s, which became, you know, it's a mecca for country music and rednecks and hippies all kind of coming together. It's
mm-hmm.
it's a pretty important legacy. And so I think they're still proud of that and they
yeah.
love that. And that's it's why. But I just don't see new generations giving a shit.
Yeah. No, I think really most of the new generations, people like my niece, mid-20s, mm-hmm. early 20s, identify Austin much more with ACL and South By. They identify it much more. It's still music, but it's not so much the dank dive bars. It's not so much your Broken Spokes, your Saxon pubs, you know, your smaller venues like that, that were really the staples of the growing Austin music scene, you know,
yeah.
Your Threadgills, places like that where, really have the longevity of history, their mind is always, of course, Sixth Street and festivals.
Yeah.
And I think it's good stuff. I'm not going to say that there isn't money there, but I don't think that the longevity of money is there.
I think it's a trend everywhere, too. And I've been putting this together, this idea. I don't know. Is that... That's if it's red, that means it's clipping, gaining, right?
You're good.
It is okay because yeah. I have the same one. I was like,
yeah,
usually okay because you're making it gain out, just so you know. Mm-hmm. But yours isn't.
Yeah,
you're making mine gain out, mm-hmm. but that's all good.
Yeah,
okay.
You're good.
So anyway, so even in Portland, I mean, it's just I was talking to some of my old bandmates, and it's just insanely tough there. I mean, even there's 3 or 4 venues that we used to play at all the time. That's we'd make a living at. This nobody's doing live music. It's all the DJs are nothing.
Yes,
it's very few people, and I think that's going to happen here. I mean,
it already is happening here. It happens all over the place.
Yeah,
and that trend really started to take over a while back, where it was like. I think it's really much harder on original musicians than sure. musicians that and I guess I should really define that as I have before on this show. The difference between at least the differentiation I make between musician and artist. An artist is someone that is writing original material, putting original material out there. Money, no money. They're making their music. They're always going to be making their music.
Sure.
And the musician is much more the person that is the applied tradesman. Wednesday night, he may be out playing jazz music. Thursday, he may be out playing hard rock. You know, he might have lessons during the day. It's much more of the, I'm going to use music as my means through which to ply my trade all the time. Do you teach lessons, things like that yourself, Eric?
Well, to go back on your other point, like, there is a difference. There is definitely a difference between the two. I have to do both all the time.
Yeah.
Like I'm still, like, I'll take a gig playing. You know, I just played yesterday with someone with Ben Ballmer. I just played lead guitar basically, mm-hmm. you know, I'll do that all day long if I can. But you know what I do a lot of? My side hustle tends to be flipping, fixing gear, computers.
Yep.
Sometimes I've even fixed cars and been able to eventually turn a profit. So that's kind of more along my lines because it's independent. Though I do want to start taking on some lessons again. Because they pay so well, but I just get really tired of the babysitting ones, you know.
Well, and especially like, oh yeah, how'd the practice go? I didn't have time to practice my lesson this week.
Yeah,
you know that'll just rip your soul in half, especially whenever you're dealing with an adult that you're trying to teach something to. That
yeah.
you know, especially someone who's dedicated, any musician that is dedicated. To what they do, that's hard because they practice almost 24/7 to ply their trade. Even myself as an engineer, I spent a day wiring a rack. I didn't need to wire all that stuff. I really didn't even need to rack it up. It's all a bunch of spare stuff, but I love doing it. I can't not do it.
yeah.
So it's kind of the same way. In your downtime, what are you going to do? Not play guitar?
You know? Yeah. I mean, there's also, yeah, I mean, to make it, you have to kind of wear every hat. So like you, I also engineer and I've recorded most of what's on all my records mm-hmm. I've done. So I'm pretty good at that part of it now. And it's pretty nice to be able to record. But now, then I'm learning piano. I just don't want to have to depend on anybody. So that's what I fill my days with, kind of like learning new things. Even I've been doing a little bit of art on the side, like drawings and CD covers and stuff like that. Kind of whatever works, you know, to make a couple dollars here and there. And diversified. But yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely I've found it interesting being in Austin because it's very much like Portland in that people are supportive of their artists here.
It's very much here, yeah.
Yeah, there's a great community of artists. There's a great community of people out there willing to work with artists. And it's really great. Now, what are a couple of the true, I guess we already talked about some of the true downsides of moving to Austin, but what is...
Traffic sucks and it's expensive as hell. That's, other than that, it's still, I can't picture necessarily moving from here too soon.
Yeah.
I'm far from feeling like I've seen all I need to see. I mean, again, it's just the musicianship and the level of creativity is mm-hmm. so over the top. Or the amount of it, I should say. Again, it's, every city has some of the best players on the planet. Yeah. Every city. But this place has a lot. In every way, songwriting, singing, just... You want to find what you're looking for. It's plenty of choices here.
Well, and speaking of songwriting and singing, let's discuss that for a little bit, because you've been playing music since before you had double digits in your age, right? You were like early in life.
No,
you were playing music.
No, not at all.
Oh, okay. I thought you were like 8 or 9 for some reason.
No, that would have been nice, because I wouldn't have had to struggle so much. No, I never came naturally. It doesn't come natural to me. I think I just have a creative mind in a sense. But the technical side of like playing guitar or figuring out a song, none of that came natural. I couldn't sing at all. I was terrible. Very, very just embarrassingly terrible. And I had to kind of teach my... And I taught myself that stuff in Portland. You know, I think I had like a little recorder... I've been doing this for a while where I learned guitar a little bit. I learned the basics and I half-assed it like a lot of people do in high school. I was 13. And by the time I got like older, I mean, I had song ideas from the beginning. I just kind of see songs as a thing, like a picture in a sense. And it's like, you want to dress it up. It's like a, I don't know, fill in the paint over the paint in between the lines.
Yeah.
Is what it feels like. And so once I kind of get proficient enough at guitar, I would just start writing songs, totally ignored any clever vocal melody. That stuff hadn't occurred to me, even though I listened to the Beatles. But I did along for a long time. I just would try to compare like what I was doing compared to, say, the Beatles or Bob Dylan. And I'd always try to, like, because I would write something and feel like, oh, wow, this is so good, it's so good, and then people wouldn't respond. And instead of getting mad at them, I want to be, okay, if this was, say, this Bob Dylan song, they would have been like, oh my God, you're a freaking genius, you know? So I had to eventually tease apart those two things and kind of make it one. In the sense where I had to realize what my shit was lacking. And so I realized singing was one. And then I started training myself to sing. I would just kind of figure out the notes by picking them with a guitar and make my voice do that. Training myself over and over.
Okay.
To Beatles songs mostly, because they have such interesting and complex melodies.
Yeah.
So I did that for years and years and years. And it was, I feel like I was still a really bad singer, even when I started that band Giraffe Attack with mm-hmm. Ryan Sear.
Yeah.
But he was one that just constantly pushed me to sing more.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, because I mean, he's just a boss singer. And it's like, he's one of my favorite singers ever.
Yeah, he does have a great voice.
Great voice, great at using it. Like, he's got that natural thing if it exists. He at least started really young in church and stuff. But I just started tuning it, playing at Amigos and playing at all these shitty little bars and just trying new songs and pushing and pushing and trying to, you know, if I heard a thing or if I heard an artist sing a certain way and I couldn't do it, I made myself figure it out. Just same thing with guitar, and that's kind of how I learned. So I went out with these people. I'm always jealous of this, like, 13-year-old comes out of nowhere and can sing like they've been doing it for 70 years. I don't have that. Never did. I had to. That's all acquired skills. But the ideas for songs that comes easy to me, even though I hardly write any songs anymore.
Well, and like we were saying a while ago, you do most of your own engineering mm-hmm. on albums that you record, everything else. What are some of the techniques? How do you start building a track?
Oh, it depends. If I would prefer to, And this is how I did Underwater Dream, which I put out 5 years ago, my last one. We played all summer, these new songs I brought, and then we just got them down. And then at the end of the summer, we just went into the studio up in Portland with Jim Begley.
Okay.
He just got a great drum sound.
Yep.
And basically, we all played together, and we had the bass and the drums when we were done. Me and the guitar player at the time on that one was Pete Morse, who did an amazing job. And he had his own studio at Red Vault and just did his own parts. You know, when I finished mine, I'd send him to him, and he would just like make up lead guitar things and layering. And so that's how that one worked. But otherwise, I'll just start a grid. I'll find a beat. I try not to do just a click track because it's very sterile.
Yeah.
And then I, just loop a beat, and I just start strumming acoustics over it, and then sing it, and I get the structure laid out, and then I'm like, okay, let's make this guitar part better, and I'll put the guitar, and then I might layer bass. Eventually, maybe I'll layer actual drums over the top, or beat machines, more like it, like a sample program with, you know, finger drums, just kind of gritting out beats. Yep. I'll do that, because samples sound pretty amazing, and you don't have to pay anybody and deal with recording drums, which is a hellacious process.
Yes.
So, just like that, man. And then I just follow my music, and I try things, and I constantly put things down and rip it up, start over. Because I don't know until after I hear it. It sucks. But sometimes I'll have an idea. Okay, I'll get this done. I'll get it done, and I'll put it kind of in the cloud and just kind of listen to it for a few days. And that's when I'm like, no, it's not what I like. Then I have to redo it.
Yeah, and I mean, I used to do a ton of live recording for bands. And my advice to bands, especially, you know me, my heart was always with the jam bands. I loved the jam bands. And I'd always tell them, like, fight the urge. Don't listen to this on the way home tonight from the gig. Give this until tomorrow. You know, like, otherwise, I found most jam bands tend to really pick themselves apart the night of a gig if they listen to it. Like, I knew I messed that up.
Yeah.
Whereas if they wait till the next day, they're much kinder to themselves. Yeah. How long do you normally give yourself between recording a track and especially once you're to the point of finalization, you're to the point of, you know, things are kind of where you want them. I'm going to put this away right now. How long do you normally give yourself to kind of come back as a blank slate and listen to that track again?
Well, it just depends. I mean, like recently I've been putting organ parts down on some songs. Mm. And I mean, I could go all of a sudden just kind of get onto a different song for a while and just not touch them for 6 months. But as far as like finalizing a track, I just kind of know. Because mixing is as much of a pain in the ass as recording. Because I'll go through sometimes 15, 25 mixes easy, like when I'm trying to finalize. But usually I know when it's like right down. Like I can let go. I know like when I just know when it's done. Some people would disagree, but there's a point when I know, like when a lyric tweak or whatever it is just fills everything into place the way I want it. So you never know. I just don't know. But I'm very slow in that sense. Like I wish I had more of that Picasso side where you just like throw something out and it's just and go
throw with stuff on the canvas, like, and Dylan, see what happens.
Dylan could just like just keep putting stuff out there, and just he would just bring in these amazing songs. They wouldn't happen in the first take. You'd go to the next song and never do it again. You know, I mean, I just don't have that. I would like to have that kind of output. I mean, I just, I don't know why. I just have these visions, and it's perfectionist streak, I think, that I fight a little bit.
Sure.
So it's always a struggle, but I'm trying to get better at just being okay with like things not being perfect, because perfect albums are really boring.
Yeah, so. I'm very much the same way. But as we sit here, you can see all my beat machines and keyboards, and I don't play to click tracks. I don't do all that kind of stuff. I'm very much organic and in the moment with what I'm doing. Even when I do compose, it's much more of a bar graph of what sound for what duration than it is notes and melody and harmony. How do you go about writing as a singer-songwriter? Is it something that words or harmony comes first, or melody, rhythm? How does your brain normally work when you're crafting a song to begin with?
Mixed bag, all of the above. I could just kind of be... I find actually one of the techniques that I really need to employ more often is sometimes I'll hear certain songs and all of a sudden the lyrics will just... I'll just start making up lyrics in my head to that melody. It happens all the time with like the Mallet Brothers music.
Oh, yeah.
I love listening to it. It's so hypnotic. A lot of it is really hypnotic in a strange way. And same thing for another Maynard, the Coloradas with Roy Davis's band.
Oh, okay. Like,
it's just so simple, but there's a thing, and I don't know, the lyrics just kind of spool out.
No, there's a hook to simplicity for certain.
Oh, there is. There is.
You know, I mean, that's what made so many Beatles songs so popular, despite the fact they have all of six, maybe seven chords in them.
That's never ending fascination.
Yeah. You've always been a huge, huge Beatles fan. Do you find that the music that you listen to actively influences the music that you write? Like if you're in a Beatles mode, do you get caught in that with your fingers on the fret?
No, I think it's all the same thing. I think the reason I'd be listening to the Beatles is the same reason I'd be writing what I'm writing. Like it's just, I'm in that mood, like whatever it is, like music and what mood I'm in is always such an involuntary thing. So to me, if I'm listening to Led Zeppelin, it's because something within me wants to, and that's it. You know, and I'll go long periods of time without listening to kind of anything, and it always scares me a little bit. But it always comes back, and I'll just start getting obsessed with this song or that song. You never know what it's going to be.
Yeah.
Or who, what band. But it's usually I get obsessed with a song. And I don't know how much that influences my playing. I know what will happen, and it will influence my bag of tricks, is I'll learn the song usually to try to quiet it, you know. Been doing that a lot too. Like, I think, just for example, I think not the last song, I was just totally, I couldn't get out of my head, annoyingly, was like Farewell Angelina by Bob Dylan.
Okay.
So I just started playing that on piano over and over and trying to do the melody and keep the chords going. And then it's just a great way to practice piano and learn a song and also get it the hell out of your head for a second.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So I do that with pretty much everything, I think. Once a song just is dogging me, I'll learn it somehow. I'll make it my own version. Sometimes they make it to be a lot. You know, I'll play them live. That helps.
Yeah. But, well, as we wrap this episode, your last album, which was Dream Underwater?
An Underwater Dream.
An Underwater Dream.
Yeah.
And your new album that will be released hopefully in a few months.
I want it out before April, because if I go 5 years without having actually released an album, I'm going to be... I'll probably be fine, but I'm going to be somewhat disappointed with myself for a few hours.
Yeah. I'm about the same way. I like to release things at least once a year, at least something.
I want to start doing way more than that. I've got the material, so...
Yeah.
This is, I hope, going to be kind of a good canon push. Actually, I should say that I did release one track featuring Spose, the rapper.
Okay.
He's one of my favorites. He's kind of my music obsession the last few years. Guy's super brilliant. We did a track. Jeff Beam put together something called The Main Embassy, and it was a tribute to the Beatles. And all different bands got different tracks. And I got Why Don't We Do It in the Road.
Oh, yeah.
And I worked on it for so long, and I just was having a lot of trouble figuring out what direction. It was just basically a drum piano jam. I wasn't going to do what they did. Not even close. So there was this whole cool instrumental part, and I was like, man, do you want to make up some rap? And he said, yeah. So that was cool. That came out in July, I think, and that's on Bandcamp.
Okay.
You can put in my name, and Why Don't We Do It in the Road, it'll come up in Spose.
And where can people go to find the old music and the new music soon to be released of Eric Bettencourt?
I've recently uploaded all of my catalogs to Spotify and all the regular iTunes, all that stuff. Yeah. It's all up to Amazon. I was a whole other struggle of like why we still cost a ton of money to put this music out and no one's buying it. Like, why am I doing this, you know? It's when I realized, like, just I gotta get it out there.
Yeah.
And have it out there. So I've got 5 albums on Spotify right now. One of them is a cover EP, which I'm still proud of and I'm happy. It's the first time it's been streaming.
Okay.
It just came out like a month ago. So I'm really happy with that. But yeah, so it's all up there. And yeah. You can buy CDs at my website when it's back up, or Bandcamp.
Yep.
You can buy CDs directly if you do that. Vinyl records, t-shirts, I have all that stuff too.
Fantastic, yeah. Please do make sure to go by and check out the great, awesome music of Eric Betancourt. Buy CDs, buy merch, support your local artists, folk. That is what this music thing is all about. While you're online checking out the great music of Eric Betancourt, please do make sure to stop on by the Talking Sound Podcast, talkingsoundpodcast.com or talkingsoundshow.com. That's where you can find not only all the episodes, but also great articles from the industry, from manufacturers like Canon, MXL Microphones, Rupert Neve, so much more. You can also find there the Freelance AV Directory, only one in the country that I'm aware of. Where it's actually just a list of companies that hire freelance AV hands. If you're someone like me that makes your living out on the road doing audio, video, camera work, whatever, go check it out. It's right there on the website. Also, make sure to check out the HC Universal Network, our parent network, and all the great stuff there like Dudes and Beer, Therapy Hour with Rusty Lozano, Yes But Why podcast, as well as other great shows. Until next time, everybody, remember, keep reaching for 11, and we'll talk to you soon. Take care. Bye-bye.